Chapter 24. Presently, Lingard tried to remember Mrs. Travers' features, even as she sat within 2 feet of him in the boat. He seemed to have taken from that vanished schooner not a woman, but a memory, a tormenting recollection of a human being he would see no more. At every stroke of the short sculls, Mrs. Travers felt the boat leap forward with her. Lingard, to keep his direction, had to look over his shoulder frequently. "Who will be safe in the brig?" he said. She was silent. A dream. A dream. He lay back vigorously. The water slapped loudly against the blunt bows. The ruddy glow thrown afar by the flares was reflected deep within the hood. The dream had a pale visage. The memory had living eyes. "I had to come for you myself," he said. "I expected it of you." These were the first words he had heard her say since they had met for the third time. "And I swore before you, too, that I would never put my foot on board your craft." "It was good of you to," she began. "I forgot somehow," he said, simply. "I expected it of you," she repeated. He gave 3 quick strokes before he asked very gently, "What more do you expect?" "Everything," she said. He was rounding then the stern of the brig, and had to look away. Then he turned to her. "And you trust me too," he exclaimed. "I would like to trust you," she interrupted, "because," above them a startled voice cried in Malay, "Captain coming." The strange sound silenced her. Lingard laid in his sculls and she saw herself gliding under the high side of the brig. A dark, staring face appeared very near her eyes. Black fingers caught the gunwale of the boat. She stood up swaying. "Take care," said Lingard again, but this time, in the light, did not offer to help her. She went up alone, and he followed her over the rail. The quarter deck was thronged by men of 2 races. Lingard and Mrs. Travers crossed it rapidly between the groups that moved out of the way on their passage. Lingard threw open the cabin door for her, but remained on deck to inquire about his boats. They had returned while he was on board the yacht, and the 2 men in charge of them came aft to make their reports. The boat sent north had seen nothing. The boat which had been directed to explore the banks and islets to the south had actually been in sight of Damon's Cross. The man in charge reported that several fires were burning on the shore, the crews of the 2 Cross being encamped on a sandbank. Cooking was going on. They had been near enough to hear the voices. There was a man keeping watch on the ridge. They knew this because they heard him shouting to the people below, by the fires. Lingard wanted to know how they had managed to remain unseen. "The night was our hiding place," answered the man in his deep growling voice. He knew nothing of any white men being in Damon's camp. Why should there be? Raja Assam and the lady, his sister, appeared unexpectedly near his boat in their canoe. Raja Assam had ordered him then in whispers to go back to the brig at once and tell Tuan what he had observed. Raja Assam said also that he would return to the brig with more news very soon. He obeyed because the Raja was to him a person of authority, having the perfect knowledge of Tuan's mind as we all know. "No," cried Lingard, suddenly. The man looked up heavily for a moment, and retreated forward without another word. Lingard followed him with irritated eyes. A new power had come into the world, had possessed itself of human speech, had imparted to it a sinister irony of illusion. To be told that someone had perfect knowledge of his mind startled him and made him wince. It made him aware that now he did not know his mind himself, that it seemed impossible for him ever to regain that knowledge. And the new power not only had cast its spell upon the words he had to hear, but also upon the facts that assailed him, upon the people he saw, upon the thoughts he had to guide, upon the feelings he had to bear. They remained what they had ever been, the visible surface of life open in the sun to the conquering tread of an unfettered will. Yesterday they could have been discerned clearly, mastered and despised. But now another power had come into the world, and had cast over them all the wavering gloom of a dark and inscrutable purpose. Two, recovering himself with a slight start, Lingard gave the order, to extinguish all the lights in the brig. Now the transfer of the crew from the yacht had been effected, there was every advantage in the darkness. He gave the order from instinct, it being the right thing to do in the circumstances. His thoughts were in the cabin of his brig, where there was a woman waiting. He put his hand over his eyes, collecting himself as if before a great mental effort. He could hear about him the excited murmurs of the white men whom in the morning he had so ardently desired to have safe in his keeping. He had them there now, but accident, ill luck, a cursed folly, had tricked him out of the success of his plan. He would have to go in and talk to Mrs. Travers. The idea dismayed him. Of necessity he was not one of those men who have the mastery of expression. To liberate his soul was for him a gigantic undertaking, a matter of desperate effort, of doubtful success. I must have it out with her, he murmured to himself, as though at the prospect of a struggle. He was uncertain of himself, of her, he was uncertain of everything and everybody, but he was very certain he wanted to look at her. At the moment he turned to the door of the cabin, both flares went out together, and the black vault of the night upheld above the brig by the fierce flames, fell behind him, and buried the deck in sudden darkness. The buzz of strange voices instantly hummed louder with a startled note. H. Hallo! Ain't see a mortal thing, L. What next? Insisted a voice. Want to know what next? Lingard checked himself, ready to open the door, and waited absurdly for the answer, as though in the hope of some suggestion. What's up with you? Think yourself lucky, said somebody. Tea's all very well for tonight, began the voice. Had are you fashing yourself for? Remonstrated the other, reasonably. We'll get home right enough. I'm not so sure, the second matey says. Ever mind what he says. That ear man who has got this brig will see us through. The owner's wife will talk to him, she will. Money can do a lot. The two voices came nearer, and spoke more distinctly, close behind Lingard. S suppose them blooming savages set fire to the yacht. What's to prevent them? And D suppose they do. This ear brig's good enough to get away in. Ain't she? Guns and all. We'll get home yet all right. What do you say, John? I say nothing and care less, said a third voice, peaceful and faint. Do you mean to say, John, you would go to the bottom as soon as you would go home? Come now. Oh, the bottom, repeated the one voice, composedly. Aye. That's where we all are going to, in one way or another. The way don't matter. Oh. You would give the blues to the funny man of a blooming circus. What would my missus say, if I wasn't to turn up never at all? He would get another man. There's always plenty of fools about. A quiet and mirthless chuckle was heard in the pause of shocked silence. Lingard, with his hand on the door, remained still. Further off a growl burst out, colon, I do hate to be chucked in the dark aboard a strange ship. I wonder where they keep their fresh water. Can't get any sense out of them silly niggers. We don't seem to be more account here than a lot of cattle. Likely as not we'll have to berth on this blooming quarter deck for God knows how long. Then again very near Lingard the first voice said, dead and discreetly here's something curious about this here brig turning up sudden like, ain't there? And that skipper of her now? What kind of a man is he anyhow? Oh, he's one of them skippers going about loose. The brig's his own, I am thinking. He just goes about in her looking for what he may pick up honest or dishonest. My brother-in-law served two commissions in these seas, and was telling me awful yarns about what's going on in them godforsaken parts. Likely he lied, though. The man of war's men are a holy terror for yarns. Bless you, what do I care who this skipper is? Let him do his best, and don't trouble your head. You won't see him again in your life once we get clear. And can he do anything for the owner? Asked the first voice again. And he? We can do nothing, that's one thing certain. The owner may be lying clubbed to death this very minute for all we know. By all accounts these savages here are a cruel murdering lot. Mind you, I am sorry for him as much as anybody. E, I, muttered the other, approvingly. He may not have been ready, poor man, began again the reasonable voice. Lingard heard a deep sigh. If there's anything as can be done for him, the owner's wife, she's got to fix it up with this here skipper. Under Providence he may serve her turn. Lingard flung open the cabin door, entered, and, with a slam, shut the darkness out. I am, under Providence, to serve your turn, he said after standing very still for a while, with his eyes upon Mrs. Travers. The brick swing lamp lighted the cabin with an extraordinary brilliance. Mrs. Travers had thrown back her hood. The radiant brightness of the little place, enfolded her so close, clung to her with such force, that it might have been part of her very essence. There were no shadows on her face. It was fiercely lighted, hermetically closed, of impenetrable fairness. Lingard looked in unconscious ecstasy at this vision, so amazing that it seemed to have strayed into his existence from beyond the limits of the conceivable. It was impossible to guess her thoughts, to know her feelings, to understand her grief or her joy. But she knew all that was at the bottom of his heart. He had told her himself, impelled by a sudden thought, going to her in darkness, in desperation, in absurd hope, in incredible trust. He had told her what he had told no one on earth, except perhaps, at times, himself, but without words less clearly. He had told her, and as he had listened in silence, as he had listened leaning over the rail till at last her breath was on his forehead. He remembered this, and had a moment of soaring pride, and of unutterable dismay. He spoke, with an effort. You've heard what I said just now? Here I am. Do you expect me to say something? She asked. Is it necessary? Is it possible? No, he answered. I had said already. I know what you expect from me. Everything. Everything, she repeated, paused, and added much lower, it is the very least. He seemed to lose himself in thought. It is extraordinary, he reflected half aloud, how I dislike that man. She leaned forward a little. Remember, those two men are innocent, she began. So am I innocent. So is everybody in the world. Have you ever met a man, or a woman that was not? They've got to take their chances all the same. I expect you to be generous, she said. To you? Well, to me. Yes, if you like, to me alone. To you alone. And you know everything. His voice dropped. You want your happiness. She made an impatient movement and he saw her clench the hand that was lying on the table. I want my husband back, she said, sharply. Yes. Yes. It's what I was saying. Same thing, he muttered with strange placidity. She looked at him searchingly. He had a large simplicity that filled one's vision. She found herself slowly invaded by this masterful figure. He was not mediocre. Whatever he might have been, he was not mediocre. The glamour of a lawless life stretched over him like the sky over the sea, down on all sides to an unbroken horizon. Within, he moved very lonely, dangerous and romantic. There was in him crime, sacrifice, tenderness, devotion, and the madness of a fixed idea. She thought with wonder that of all the men in the world he was indeed the one she knew the best, and yet she could not foresee the speech or the act of the next minute. She said distinctly, "You've given me your confidence. Now I want you to give me the life of these two men. The life of two men whom you do not know, whom tomorrow you will forget. It can be done. It must be done. You cannot refuse them to me." She waited. "Why can't I refuse?" he whispered, gloomily, without looking up. "You ask," she exclaimed. He made no sign. He seemed at a loss for words. "You ask. Da da da," she cried. "Don't you see that I have no kingdoms to conquer?" 3. A slight change of expression which passed away almost directly showed that Lingard heard the passionate cry wrung from her by the distress of her mind. He made no sign. She perceived clearly the extreme difficulty of her position. The situation was dangerous, not so much the facts of it as the feeling of it. At times it appeared no more actual than a tradition, and she thought of herself as of some woman in a ballad who has to beg for the lives of innocent captives. To save the lives of Mr. Travers and Mr. Delcasser was more than a duty. It was a necessity, it was an imperative need, it was an irresistible mission. Yet as he had to reflect upon the horrors of a cruel and obscure death, before she could feel for them the pity they deserved. It was when she looked at Lingard that her heart was wrung by an extremity of compassion. The others were pitiful, but he, the victim of his own extravagant impulses, appeared tragic, fascinating, and culpable. Lingard lifted his head. Whispers were heard at the door and Hassam followed by Amada entered the cabin. Mrs. Travers looked at Lingard, because of all the faces in the cabin his was the only one that was intelligible to her. Hassam began to speak at once, and when he ceased Amada's deep sigh was heard in the sudden silence. Then Lingard looked at Mrs. Travers and said, "The gentlemen are alive. Raja Hassam here has seen them less than 2 hours ago, and so has the girl. They are alive and unharmed, so far. And now..." Dot, he paused. Mrs. Travers, leaning on her elbow, shaded her eyes under the glint of suspended thunderbolts. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.